All right, we might get started. Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to the session on retirement incomes, approaches to member cohorting, segmentation and outcomes analysis. I'm Saffron Sweeney and I'll be the chair and host for today. And just a reminder that if you do have questions, please go to the app and we'll hope to have some great time for discussion after Michael does his presentation. So I'd like to introduce you to Michael Dermody. He is the partner and actuarial and financial risk in KPMG. So Michael's going to take us through his session and then we can do questions. Thank you.
Thanks, Saffron. Well, this morning at the plenary session, it said all lawyers make the RIC too complicated, so I've brought along my own lawyer. So hopefully Lisa doesn't take too much offence. So this presentation is actually supported by a paper which has been on the Institute website since last week. But for those of you who haven't had a chance to read it, the paper and this presentation is basically in two parts, and it's trying to answer some of those more detailed questions that came in the plenary actually today. So it's trying to answer the questions around, well, what do funds need to do in answering the RIC? And there's two things they need to do. They need to improve their understanding of members, and they need to improve their understanding of the retirement strategies available and how they deliver into members' preferences and circumstances. So half of the sessions is on, member cohorting and understanding members, and half of the session then is actually on looking at some strategies and how you might compare strategies and work out which strategies actually best deliver inter-member outcomes. So this diagram here sort of encapsulates how KPMG thinks about the RIC, okay, which is for a superannuation fund to actually truly say it's addressing the RIC properly and that it's satisfying, the requirements under the RIC for its members, it needs to do two things. It needs to have the best possible understanding that it can have of its members, and that includes the members' circumstances, it includes their health, and it includes their preferences, which we'll go through. So really good understanding of members, okay? And then we now have a really good understanding of the strategies available and how they deliver into those preferences. And only when we have those two things can we actually work out which strategy best suits members in different cohorts. Okay, pretty logical, not really a problem, with that conceptually. So what have we sort of found is that when super funds go through this, their members are more diverse perhaps than they expected. So when we work with clients, they've found when they're looking at members and their characteristics, they're more diverse than they're expected. I think the other thing that we've found is that super funds have done quite a bit on the understanding members piece, circumstances, maybe not so much on preferences, haven't done very much on sort of understanding strategies and how they deliver into outcomes. I think a really good challenge for super funds is that if you've got your membership and you understand your membership reasonably well and you don't have a good strategy for those members in your fund, logically you should be encouraging them to leave. They shouldn't be in your fund. And that sort of really, I think, encapsulates the challenge that super funds should think about, should think about this problem. They don't need to have the best possible, but they need to have a reasonably good strategy for the members that they think that they're well placed to serve. Okay, and now I'll hand over to Lisa, who's going to talk a little bit about the cohorting and the RIC requirements.
Thanks, Michael. Good afternoon, everyone. So hopefully I clarify rather than complicate cohorting today, but we did want to just put a regulatory context around cohorting and think about what is the job of the trustee in thinking about cohorting and thinking about the appropriate retirement income strategy. So there's no doubt there's been significant debate in the industry about what needs to be known about members in order to help them or guide them into the best retirement income strategy. But there are also differences and some difficulties for trustees practically and legally in able to obtain the data and the information that they think they might need compared to what an advisor might do in terms of giving personal advice to a member. And this really goes to the different roles that an advisor plays compared to what a trustee plays. And I think when you look at the difference between the two, you can see the differences in how decision-making is performed. So what's the trustee's role? Well, we always go back to the well-worn adage that trustees must act in the best financial interests of members. So what's really important about that is that trustees are performing their view on a collective basis. They're not doing it on an individual basis for beneficiaries, but they're doing it on a collective basis. So how do trustees do that? And trustees have always done this by looking at cohorts or classes of members. In trust law, we often talk about it as in classes of members, but really the terminology has moved on to cohorts. So really all that means is that trustees divide the members and beneficiaries into cohorts with common characteristics, and then they test a decision that needs to be made or a strategy that needs to be tested against those cohorts. And what the trustee is looking for is the impacts. What are the positive impacts? What are the negative impacts for those groups of members? Once a trustee figures that out, the trustee's job is then to weigh the positive against the negative, and then form a view on what is in collectively the best financial interests of members. Now, when you think about that approach, of course, sometimes there'll be detriment identified. There will be outliers. So then the trustee needs to think, can I act to solve some of that detriment? Can I act to accommodate the outliers? But in thinking about that, the trustee also needs to think about the underlying cost of that. And that goes to Michael's point. Do you adapt your decision or your strategy to accommodate, or is that just outside what is members' best financial interests? And so should that sort of member be in a different fund? So the key challenge is really how you defined your member cohorts. And that really comes back to your understanding of members. So if we bring this back to retirement, trustees are going to be testing their retirement income strategy at the collective member level. They're going to look at their cohorting in retirement, and they're going to look also at their sub-cohort characteristics to see if they can meet their member needs with their strategy in those groups of members. And as we said, the analysis of your cohorting should bring out those outliers. And so then there's a decision to be made about how the trustee needs to actively think about those outliers. That brings us to perhaps one of my favourite topics, and that is segmentation. And in our view, it's actually important to distinguish cohorting from segmentation. And we hear those terms confused all of the time. We use them interchangeably. And in fact, in the guidance, the regulator uses them interchangeably. But in our view, segmentation is really better thought of as part of your marketing strategy within a cohort. So it helps you define your engagement strategy, your education, whether or not you can give appropriate nudges to members within the cohorts or across cohorts. So really what we're saying here is segmentation helps you with your customer journey, within and over the various cohorts. Now, why is that important? It's important because I hear a lot of language around, we have a cohort of one. Has anyone heard that language? We cohort to one. Now, if you think about that in terms of how a trustee makes decisions, if you have a cohort of one, the natural consequence of that is that if you have 1 million members, you have 1 million cohorts. You can't possibly test your strategy against 1 million cohorts. So really what I think people mean when they say they have a cohort of one is what they're wanting to do is to provide a customer journey that has the ability to be personalised by the member or their advisor. So I think that's really what we're getting at when we use that language. So you've really got to take care around what is the role of the trustee in collective decision making, what is your marketing strategy underneath, and then what is the role of an advisor? Because you can clearly see the difference. Trustee, collective decision making, advisor, personal decision-making take into account that client's individual circumstances and needs. So that brings us to data. Obviously, data is going to be important. The detailed information that you have about member needs provides incredibly valuable insights, which Michael will address. But then how you use your data or the appropriateness of your data is important. So you just can't forget those good principles around data governance, privacy, consent, etc. Also, understanding the purpose for the collection of your data is important, because when you're holding data about members individually, it's very easy to unintentionally sway into giving personal advice. So always a risk to consider. So trustees are currently working through the data they have that they can rely on, and the data that they would like to provide further insights. And over time, that data set is obviously going to get deeper to help members better understand, or trustees better understand their members. But this is also important for business planning. So when we think about the new business, the new strategic business planning standard that's coming in, the new SPS 515 on the 1st of July, we now have to make sure that your retirement income strategy is encapsulated in your business plan. That also means that your retirement cohorts are encapsulated in your business plan and are assessed through your member outcome statement and through your BPR. So like all key strategic initiatives, thought then needs to be given about how success in terms of member outcomes is measured and how it's monitored, and what are the triggers for actions when member outcomes or retirement outcomes are not achieved or not achieved as expected. And so you need good quality data in order to be able to measure that, and that then forms your continuous learning loop. How can you adjust your strategy in light of a member outcome or retirement outcome not quite hitting the mark? So how can you get into that loop of continuous improvement and adjust your strategy appropriately? So with that, Michael, I'm going to hand back to you to talk about member data.
Thanks, Lisa. And just returning to that sort of concept of, cohort of one, I think what we've seen with some super funds is that you do get that, we need to understand 100 data points on a member before we can move forward with what is the right thing for them. And therefore, we're not going to do anything with products. We're not going to do anything with the strategies. We all think 100% ABP is all fine. This is all complicated. And our view is that that is the wrong way to think about this. So as we talked about, when you understand your members, when you begin to understand them with that data, that you'll sort of realize that there's members with different needs. And what a fund needs to do is they need to be ready with the products and strategies for when a member comes to them. Because when a member comes to them, that's when they start to reveal, this is my preferences, here's all the assets outside of super, here's my spouse, here's my home ownership state. So that information that isn't available now, and we've heard sometimes, we need to understand all of this right now. We don't need to understand it all right now. We need to understand broadly our membership, what it looks like, but we only need to, when we're making an actual decision and dealing with an individual member, deal with that at that time. And some members will make their own choices as well. So what member attributes are important? And I'll go through, this in a bit more detail. This is all pretty obvious, I think, to most people. There's when we're thinking about cohorting, what attributes? Demographic and household, married, home ownership, financial circumstances. We've got some of that information. We've got their super balance. We may not have their information on their assets outside of super. Their debts and liabilities. And then the other things that I'll talk a bit about is preferences and health status. So preferences, I think it's good for maybe pause on that one a bit. So two preferences I think are really important for actuaries when we're doing our sort of data-driven analysis is stability of income. That's a fairly obvious one. What is the member's preference around stability of income? And one of the nice insights that's sort of come out recently is there's been a bit of a myth that only people of modest sort of wealth care about stability of income, and sort of actually realising, no. Like, when you actually do the analysis and talk with people, even people that are reasonably well off, there's a proportion of people that are well off, not so well off. There's a proportion through all of that sort of characteristic that prefers stability of income. So that's an interesting insight. The other one is death benefits. I'll return to the RIC. So the RIC talks about maximise risk, you know, maximise expected income, manage risk, access to lump sums. It doesn't actually mention death benefits. So you actually take the RIC literally. You're sort of going, well, it's not attributing any value to death benefits. Now, KPMG's view is that, unless there's actually a harder legislative requirement, we're really there to best serve members. If a member's got a bequest motive, we should be taking that into account in developing our cohorts. And again, this is another characteristic which is actually varies a lot. Okay, when super funds do their research, they'll find they'll have some members don't want to leave the kids a cent. You'll have some that go, yep, want to leave them a lot. Some of them will say, well, I'm going to spend all my super, but I'll leave them the house. Okay, so a huge amount of variety in terms of preferences and, you know, a really important characteristic for actuaries because as we get further into the presentation, we'll talk about, you know, well, clearly the bequest motive for death benefits important, right? That's what we're dealing with a lot is, you know, longevity products shift benefit from death benefit to living benefit. So if we're not valuing a bequest motive, we should be overlaying products which, you know, we should be overlaying longevity products because they pay more living benefit. Very simple. We all know it. Won't be the first paper that talks about that. Okay. One thing we did to try and make this a bit real is sort of have a bit of a stab using population data on what the whole Australian superannuation membership might sort of look like. It really is illustrative, so it's not, you know, I wouldn't even necessarily say it's very accurate, but it is something that some super funds are doing with their own membership is these sorts of, you know, attributes, actually trying to divide their members. As Lisa said, we can't have a million cohorts. What's a manageable number to break our membership down into to sort of understand their characteristics? This doesn't include preferences. We've just got assets outside of super. We've got home ownership. We've got single, couple. We've got good health, poor health. You know, some of the interesting insights from this one came out this morning. I think Tim, yep, some good ones there. Bit surprising maybe. Most people that retire over the next 5 to 10 years will own their own home. Yep, so that's interesting. Most people when they retire, you know, do retire as a couple, okay? But probably the overarching insight is that there's diversity. There's significant numbers in all of those areas. Another thing Tim talked about today, which is really good, was you know have people with hardly any money. You can have 30% maybe of members that have got almost nothing. You can have 30% that have got money, but maybe it's a bit less than the, you know, entitles them to a full age pension. You can have 20% of members maybe that are entitled straight away to part age pension. You can have 20% of members maybe that have got so much money they're not entitled to any age pension initially. But really starting to think about this and think about it in a digestible way. One thing that was really, I think, pleasing about this summit was the level of discussion around mortality for retirees. So there was the one, I think, yesterday that looked at socio-demographic sort of mortality levels, which is good. We probably came at it slightly differently. So obviously what's important when you're going to a longevity product and you're at that point of actually saying, right, well, I'm going into a pool and I'm going to get less if I die early, is sort of for those members being fair to them and being equitable to them around, well, you know, if you're in poor health, maybe that's not going to be a good value option for you. Yep. And in relation to cohorting as well, and for super funds, I think this is a bit overlooked. It's actually understanding that, based on these sort of statistics, there will be a significant, not the majority, but there will be a significant number of members that have a life expectancy probably at least 3 years less than a healthy person. So in the paper, we sort of talk about healthy person. We use the Rice-Warner table done for the Institute, you know, female, got age 91. Then if you're sort of looking at these diseases here, and again, this is very high level. There's not a lot of great Australian data on this, but, you know, the type of things that people would get in the UK market, impaired life annuity rates, would be, you know, diabetes, hypertension, obese, Obviously, if you've got anything like dementia, heart stroke, vascular disease, cancer, smoker. So some of those probably look a little high, but I think it's just good to put on the table. It gets overlooked a little bit. This is important. I think if those studies done yesterday, Baron, the socioeconomic, if you actually controlled for these factors and standardised these out and standardised out people that had at least $100,000 in their super balance, probably get rid of a lot of the difference, I would expect. Yep. So I think the health one's a really interesting one. Okay, so the second, that's sort of understanding members and what we need to do to sort of understand members better. Sorry, just on the health one, I should mention, I think in the UK, for example, the impaired life annuity volume is about 30%, somewhere around that. So it's significant. I think we, in that cohorting diagram thing, we've used 25%. It's going to vary a lot by fund, obviously, based on industry and occupation. Points were made around simplicity. I think, you know, if we can't get our sales of annuities up for healthy people, we aren't going to be doing stuff with impaired lives. That's just going to be a complete waste of time. So it's important not to overcomplicate this. I think another example, you know, for our insured lives, we probably go up to 150% and rate them all as standard. So, you know, 2 or 3% on, annuitant is probably not a big deal. So first part of the session, understanding members. So we've gone through a bit about understanding members. Second part of presentation, a bit around understanding outcomes. So what we did was compared what was the typical strategy people go into now, which is they're just rolling into account-based pension. Some of them aren't even converting to an account-based pension, but to the extent they are, they're typically going account-based pension, maybe same mix they had in accumulation, so a balanced mix. So what we've done with this analysis is sort of said, right, well, let's take one member, single female, 67-year-old, $500,000 balance, and let's compare that typical strategy that they'd almost always go into and compare it with another strategy, which, you know, I think a lot of super funds are looking at now. A lot of talk today around annuities unpopular, and that's all fine. One stepping stone clearly is to only put a proportion into a longevity product, okay? And yet another stepping stone is to keep the asset mix the same, so then we're not dealing with sort of, you know, market potential uplift being different. Okay, so the other thing we did with this analysis, so it's a healthy female, so have a drawdown rate that runs out at age 93, so 2 years past life expectancy, and that's about a $50,000 when you include the age pension sort of in that analysis. Okay, so we did a little bit on sort of what the metrics you might use based on the RIC. So the RIC was obviously around maximise income, manage risk, and access to lump sums, which I'll sort of go through now. So most of us have seen this sort of analysis before when you add a longevity product. So again, draw down the same, both strategies, account-based pension runs out at 93, longevity product runs out later because it's got the mortality credit, so 4 to 5 years later run out. And then I think very importantly, the income after run out is higher because the longevity product continues, even though the 60% was invested in the APP is run out. It's interesting because some of the discussion today I've heard in the sessions has been like, oh, the age pension is like a good backstop, it's a good hedge or whatever. I don't really necessarily agree with some of the case studies. When you look at, you know, living on $28,000 versus living on $32,000 or $35,000, it's a big difference, right? So we're trying to take someone who, you know, maybe couldn't go out very much or register the car and making that difference. So I just would caution people around saying, well, you know, age pension is just the hedge to all of our investment risk problems. Yeah, I don't agree with that. Sure, maybe I'll get a bit of disagreement from the audience. So this is the two strategies then. It's a little hard to follow, so I'll take you through a little bit. The green line is the difference in the retirement income that each strategy pays. So there's no difference, obviously, in the first because we've set the drawdown for both strategies to be that $52,000 where it was affordable. And then the longevity product starts to kick up after age 93. And what we've done here, because this was a CAS-based longevity product, so it has concessional asset test treatment, that's 60%, and then the 30% after 85. Yep, so there's more age pension. So what happens with this strategy is that the person would actually get more age pension early on. They draw less from their product strategy under the alternate strategy. Okay, so they're building up actually more in their product with the alternate strategy. And that's what's, you know, and so overall for this person with $500,000 using this strategy, sort of then work out if you mortality weight it as we did, then in this case, in total, the person's getting $27,000 more. Okay, mortality weighted using our mortality curve, using the Rice-Warner curve. And, you know, that's roughly $14,000 from age pension uplift and $14,000 from the product living benefit. And importantly, sorry, I should say this is all sort of real. So this isn't PV'd at the earning rate. This is just CPI and base, so all expressed in today's dollars. Sorry, I should have mentioned that at the start. Okay. And, yeah, so we did a bit, you know, obviously this is going to be different for different cohorts. So it might sound modest. Okay, that benefit sort of sounds a bit modest. A couple of key things on that is one is obviously that, the peace of mind, which has been talked about, it's really, really important. The peace of mind and the confidence to spend that comes from knowing that the longevity product is there is actually a huge benefit, which isn't quantified here. So all we've done is the quantitative. We haven't said the person changes their spending habits all over. And that's, I just want to bring that out because, you know, in the paper, we sort of put that to the side, but it's actually a really critical part of this. Of course, the other part of it is for those people who do get to 93, it's not $27,000 at all. It's much bigger. And the paper goes through that. And I want, you know, it's just focusing on what the PV of the benefit is for those who reach 93. Some of that's here, but I probably won't go through that in detail. I think for the RIC measures around managing risk, though, this is important. So the first measure with that value of income was sort of, okay, have we maximised expected income? The alternate strategy does better. So tick. If the person does a value bequest motive, we should be going with the alternate strategy. They've got the same market risk. So really that is almost case closed. Yep. And then the second part is this one, bit of managing risk around, you know, longevity risk and just showing, demonstrating how much, obviously, this strategy improves the management of longevity risk. One thing probably as actuaries will, and funds will be doing a lot more of as well, is just analysing the age pension implications. So for this person, there's an age pension improvement early on when the asset test bites. There's actually a detriment later on because the deeming rate for income is 60% of the longevity product payment. So you actually end up with slightly worse off. So this is really important in terms of understanding, well, what does this mean for outcomes? Importantly for this type of member, the benefit early on is never caught up by the detriment later on. So, you know, probably the other thing I'd emphasise is a lot of this analysis, it's not for members. It's part of Lisa's point. This is a sort of a trustee, you know, internally focused thing where we're working out what strategies to offer. The member engagement piece needs to be simple. So just in case anyone thought I was saying this is super simple. All right. Understanding outcomes. So in the paper, so obviously that's one set of assumptions. So in the paper, we sort of go through, well, what if we vary this? Because a lot of people are sceptical, you know, what if this or that or the other thing? So, you know, change the drawdown rate. A lot of people like to have a higher drawdown rate earlier and a lower when the person's frail. Doesn't really change the results very much. Change investment assumptions also not necessarily changed a lot. So obviously the desire for death benefit changes it. The health changes it, obviously. So we threw in a member there who had a six-year lower life expectancy. Probably the other thing, if you look at the other cohorts, so just some interesting facts. For non-homeowners, you get a better asset test treatment, but you actually get the same income test treatment. So it's actually the non-homeowners that can actually be worse with a CAS compliant product. Okay, because it's the income test, you actually don't get any additional leeway on the income test. So it's really important when you think about these things like couple, you know, homo, you know, lots of assets outside of super, bit of difference or whatever, but probably, you know, home ownership was one which made a bit of difference, as well as health. Right. I'll wind up. Maybe the other RIC objective was access to lump sums. There's a lot of talk around we've got three objectives to hit and it's really complicated, and it is, but we need to simplify it, okay? So with working with some clients, rather than sort of look at access to lump sums as like a continuum, a continuous function of valuing more or less, what with some clients we'll work with has sort of said, well, let's have a look at this. When we're doing a strategy which is already 60% ABP and a longevity product which has got a little bit of withdrawal benefit, it's actually meeting all the requirements. So treating more like a binary for certain cohorts, is it adequate? Yes. Not, okay, well, the ABP one is a lot better, or so let's give it a bit more of a credit. No, they're both adequate. Tick, done. And I think as actuaries, we need to find a way to simplify some of these complex things and not have, you know, triple optimization complexities going on there. So I'll probably wind up now. Maybe just in conclusion, actuaries got a huge role to play here. As Lisa said, under the RIC, under 515, these analyses need to be data-driven and evidence-based. Yeah? What a lot of super funds have done is talked about these things qualitatively. I'm sure as actuaries, we've all heard this. Yep. Our members do this or that or the other thing. So they're all sort of, they're qualitative discussions. They're not based in rigor. They're not based in data. And that's where actuaries have a huge role to play in terms of both analysis of members and analysis of strategies and outcomes. I might wind it up there. Saffron?
Yep. Great. Thank you, Michael and Lisa. Come on. I'll move there. So we already do have some questions. So I'll try and run through them because I think they're really great to sort of share what other people are thinking as well as get some more views from both of you. So I think I'll start with the first one because it is for you, Lisa. SPS 515 requirements, do you envisage the impact of the retirement strategy on member outcomes being included in the member outcomes assessment, which is publicly disclosed, or the BPR, which is not?
I think it actually goes in both. Because you do need to assess your member outcomes. When we look at the guidance, it's probably more in your BPR, and assessing it against your cohorts. But my personal view is that it needs to go in both.
Thank you. So Michael, are you recommending a separate cohort for those in poor health? It was one of your earlier slides.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a really difficult one. I think, as actuaries, the first thing we need to do is recognise that longevity products represent lower value for people in poor health. And, I think it's a really interesting question when we're talking about possibly soft defaulting and nudges and whatever. How do we give people information or education to help them? I think a lot of the time they'll self-identify, but it is something that's important to understand. There is a materiality lens as well to it about how poor in health. Some people say, well, also they might be married to someone who's healthy. So I just think it's a very important thing not to lose sight of. I don't necessarily have all the answers. It's very private. It's very sensitive information. You're probably not going to get it readily. It's one to be aware of. How are you going to elucidate that through your member education information? The UK issues a paper on annuity do's and don'ts. Now, we don't have enough of that in Australia. There's not enough profile of annuities and the issues with them, and that's one of the reasons they're not selling. So the government needs to be communicating, funds need to be communicating, advertisements, and part of that communication of do's and don'ts is, an obvious one is you're going to reduce your access to lump sums, but one is if you're in poor health, it's probably not your thing. So I think the government has a bit of a role there too.
Yeah, thank you. There was a commenty question here about how, you know, obviously that's confidential information, often health information, and so members won't want to necessarily share that, and so it's more about giving them that guidance so that they can make a decision that hopefully is then in their better interests rather than, them making the wrong one because they don't understand the situation. We've got another question here. If cohorting exercises inevitably creates outliers, so originally Lisa was talking about the outliers, we didn't really get into it after that. Is there a process in place currently to inform those outliers? I don't know if a member wants to know that they're an outlier, but anyway, or one to be put in place by trustees, and then also should trustees make recommendations on where the outliers go alternatively, which again starts looking at advice. I'll ask you first, Lisa.
I think trustees will need to think about strategies for communicating that if you're in a particular set, if you like, or in a particular cohort or have particular characteristics, perhaps trustees will need to think about a communication strategy. And that's not to pick up on the members' personal information. It's more around members that have these characteristics. Perhaps this isn't the product for you. I would not go further than that and say, I think you should go over to, you know, the retirement strategy and X fund. That's certainly going too far. But we have certainly seen previously a regulatory stance around other things where trustees have really had, I use the word obligation, but I use it advisedly. There's a regulatory expectation that trustees do communicate that maybe this isn't the best fund for you.
Yeah, look, part of this presentation was bringing out that if you've got members who don't value a bequest benefit and you've got you don't have a longevity product, that's the first thing this presentation says, then I'm not sure. You're definitely going to have members who don't value a bequest motive. So how can you not have a longevity product? Doesn't make any sense. Now, when you get to more niche, you know, so putting the challenge to that 100% ABP is a good strategy for everyone in my fund. So, and it'd be good to people, I'm sure people disagree with me, so it'd be great to have people speak. But, you know, that just would not seem right. Now, I guess with Lisa then we're talking about like other little niches. But that's obviously a big one that stands out right at the moment. You know, there's going to be 30%, whatever it is, of members who don't care about a bequest motive and you don't have a longevity product. Okay? How does, not sure how that works. Yep.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, my experience, I had a fund that was trying to buy out pensioners years ago and one said, I don't have any dependents. I just want to live. So he wanted the longevity pension. We couldn't buy him out. So another question here is, are you looking at different cohorting once members are in retirement, in the retirement phase?
Yeah, I mean, I think one thing we don't look at is, you know, people making different decisions at different times. I don't know if that's what that's getting at. But, yeah, so, you know, some people might decide to do something at age 70 or 75 or, you know, to make this practical, this was about, you know, a member's making a decision at a point in time. We picked a 67-year-old, but equally it could be someone's wants to make a decision later or earlier, or they want to continually make decisions. So, you know, we need to be assisting them as best we can whenever they're ready to do something. And sometimes there's an assumption that people do things always at one time. I don't know if that's answered the question. People might want to speak, or Lisa, you might have a view.
If I could perhaps add, I have seen funds who do have more than one cohort in retirement. They might have early retirement and later retirement. And so what they're thinking about is how do members' needs change between those two cohorts. And so that also goes to, if you like, the softer side of retirement income strategy, about the support that members might need, the education in getting to that later stage in retirement, and the support they might need in terms of how they access the fund and fund information when they're in that later stage of retirement. So it's also that softer side of an entire, if you like, retirement income strategy.
We've got one at the floor, please.
Hi, guys. Really good presentation. Maybe the best one I've seen at Summit. One of the things that other sessions have talked about is like how complex this business is. And when you get to retirees, they're typically not financially literate, educated a long time ago. It's hard with the complicated business. The slide where you can show that if you put some of your money into an annuity, I'm from Challenger, so I'm conflicted in this. Just forget that for a minute. But you'll get more pension next week, the week after, and you get, at the back end, you'll get the pension plus the longevity product. That is tangible. You can explain that to anybody, and it's real. And there's got to be a cohort for whom that's important. And I feel if you could knock that cohort off, APRA and ASIC would look at you as a trustee and saying, you're taking care of the people who need to be taken care of the most. Like, this to me is low-hanging fruit. And I wonder if there's some aspect of this that I'm missing. Is it far more complicated than that? Because I think I could explain that to my dad. And that's a big statement.
I'm in your boat. I'm completely miffed about it. It's very simple. And I don't understand why there hasn't been more pressure put on this. Yeah, and some of these slides, Lisa and I are presenting, are ones that we've used in with funds and with various stakeholders.
Another one from the floor.
Yep. Estelle Liu from AMP. Sorry, it's a bit hot. So we have a cohort of one. I'll start with that. I guess an important distinction there is that. So cohorts could be quite helpful in informing a strategy design in terms of all the key considerations. But in delivering the retirement solution, so it has to be personalized. So I think a lot of the the elements and characteristics that you described there come down to preferences, come down to health. So those information are not something that funds can or would want to possess at scale or, be able to have at scale with reliability. So we have to come down to personalized sort of delivery. I just wanted to, ask, so whether that is also the way that you're thinking about that, so with the delivery, keen to hear your thoughts on that.
Thanks, Estelle. No, I understand where you're coming from when you say you have a cohort of one, which is actually about the personalization of the journey. And about providing an ability for members to personalise. When I speak about cohort of one with my lawyer hat on, what I'm thinking on is how's a trustee make a decision? And so I expect in your strategy you have broader categories at the top by which the trustee tests their decision and how they form their view that it's in the best financial interest of members. So, yes, I completely understand when you say you're a cohort of one for that personalisation journey. I think it's just a confusion of terminology in the industry because when I think about it with that decision-making hat on for a trustee, it's different.
I think Lisa, the other thing that you and I, when we've been presenting to people, and this also gets missed a lot, Peter Chun talked today around, almost like a lot, the majority advised, almost everyone advised, in our view, right, you're always going to have people that get an advisor. You're always going to have people that go through a digital journey and get a bit of help. You're always going to have people that are going to have digital journey and not phone up at all. And then you're always going to have people that are going to get your information, whatever else, not going to go on digital and they're going to decide. And what I think has been helpful working with Lisa on is, what the RIC is about is giving your best assistance across all of those people. Obviously you'll try and get them engaged, you'll provide better information and guidance and whatever, but you're really trying to give the best possible assistance to all of those people.
So there's one more question here. How far down the track are you to making any of this a reality with your clients?
Some of this stuff is actually based on client engagement. So like the cohorting stuff and dividing up, that's actual client work. So one guidance, let's say, for actuaries working in this space is that some of the clients who are really on top of this, they can really help you simplify it. So I gave the example about the access to lump sums. That was a client that said that. They said, we understand our members, we understand this, that they're going to be happy at this stage. That's fine. Another one is the drawdown rates. There's a lot of conjecture and debate around what's the optimal. Should you have lots when you're, well, and then when you're old and frail, less? There's debates around that. You might say, well, aged care costs are high. But when you're working with a client or if you're inside a fund working with the execs there, they'll give you guidance. They'll say, use this one. Yep. And it helps to make the analysis easy because there's, as you can see, there's lots of variables that you can work through if you don't sort of control it.
Looks like we've got another one from the floor. Thank you.
Hi, Nick Hill here from McGing Advised and Actuarial. I'm just going to take a contrarian or sort of devil's advocate view. I look at my dad, but they're this in the UK, and if he goes in, oh, what the hell do I do? And if he doesn't get the answer from the fund, he goes to ChatGPT or asks a relative or something like that. But and then you look at it from a member's perspective. How many cohorts are there? There's just, you know, the current default is stay in a cume. That's the default. It's like cohort of, not cohort of one, it's one cohort. I continue in a cume until something happens. Question to you guys. I download an app. It asks me some really nice questions like, how old are you? You know, how are you doing? If there were three questions that any super fund, when you log into their app or their website, what questions should they ask so that they could have quite decent cohorting based on the data they've got? And it's just simple questions. What three questions could they ask?
You can take that one. This is an advice fund.
I'd have to think about that one.
I can talk to a couple of things. Yeah, I'll give you time to think about it. So I think the problem in Australia why annuities haven't been successful, and this is misunderstood, right, is members trust their fund and they trust the government, okay? So there hasn't been enough volume of information from the government and funds about annuities, how they help, what they do, okay? So that whole volume, you know, In the UK, I said, you've got to do and don't cheats of annuities. In the UK, you've got your uncle, which I think is a great point, right? Like the whole, you know, you can have the best car in the world. You put on the net, who's going to buy it, right? Like the whole understanding, familiarity, profile of annuities has to go up. And in countries, we need to be realistic, in countries where the profile is up, it's still probably only 20%, right? So we're just trying to get from, I don't know, Martin, you can tell us, 3% or whatever, to 20%. That's what we're trying to do here. So the questions or whatever, you're right, the funds need to do a lot more education, needs to be built earlier so that people are aware. The whole familiarity and comfort around this needs to go through the roof, and without it, it's not going to work. It's not some of it's a product problem, but, you know, advertising, you know, government, fund, leaning into it, it's the funds, you know, the funds need to promote this a lot more. So I'll get off my soapbox now, Lisa. Is that probably got enough time now to think of an answer?
I wouldn't say I'm the expert in what information would be required, but it is actually a strategy that funds are using. So we see that funds are looking at the information that they get from their calculators, and they're using that, and I think we've talked about that, Michael, yeah. They're using that information in order to inform the data they have for their retirement income strategy. And we also see funds that have some sort of digital assist in terms of advice, or perhaps their advice arm has digital assist in terms of advice rather than the fund itself. But they are actually drawing information, anonymised information, I might say, about characteristics of their members to help inform their retirement income strategy. I guess the question is, what's the quality and reliability of that data? If you're anything like me, as soon as you get a calculator, you're trying all different options, which might be how you might think about what you'd like to have in the future rather than actually what you will actually have. So, you know, there's a quality issue there as well.
I'm just going to make a quick comment. Adrian from Tao. I think the one question is, do you think you're going to live over 87?
You're me?
That sounds like an actuarial question, Mark, rather than a legal one.
My BMI is over 30, so no, I'm not a good spot. I don't know. Yeah.
So obviously we've had a great discussion, but Michael was wondering if anyone had an opposing idea. We had a small devil's advocate sort of update before. Obviously the age pension does play a big part in this, Michael, and you mentioned before, you know, it's really quite low, $27,000 per annum to live off. And, you know, I think it's, if you haven't seen it firsthand, I think you don't realize what that means to live off. It's actually a small amount of money. And, you know, it's expectations as well. I think the newer, retirees are certainly expecting a lot different than what maybe my nana, who was on the age pension and literally could eat and live, but didn't go anywhere. She stayed in her home, read books until she couldn't read anymore, watch television. That's her retirement. That was her life. Now, I don't think the majority of the coming up and coming generations expect that that is retirement. So I think it's a part of it's about expectation as well. And if they're not expecting that I'm just going to sit and watch telly and that's all I can do in retirement, then we want to sort of at least have them understand that, well, you need to think about these things so that you can build it up to have more. And again, it's always that balance of the here and now. Spend more now. You don't have it in the future. And that's that balancing act as well. You know, you don't want to totally not live now and then have stuff in the future that you might not be alive for. So again, it's that balance. And I don't think we've discussed that. Has anyone got anything they want to discuss on those items?
I think people should, I think there's a really good program in, what the government does if you qualify for the age pension, the home equity release.
Yes.
But I was helping my in-laws and they just are over that limit that they can't get it. And it's sort of like if they go to a commercial product, the interest rate's like 10%. And so people like your Nana, if she could have had a home equity release, her life could have been totally different.
That's right. And again, it's education. And look, yeah, it wasn't so much around when she was going through that. But yeah, I think a lot of this is education. And I think that's the issue with the income products. And I think Australia hasn't spoken about income in retirement for very long. It's become a thing we've talked about more recently. And it's still in this room kind of stuff. I don't think the general person still thinks about income in retirement. And I think that would change the game if they see it more as income in retirement, but we've got a long way to go because it's not the current thinking. It's not how people think about their super. Yeah.
Yeah. One of the, some of the case studies I really liked, you know, Saffron, we talked about this in getting ready, were some of the UK ones because they actually talk more about people who aren't earning very much and how, as I said, things move from, you know, being able to maintain a car or go out to dinner when other people are going out to dinner, you know. We've got this strange thing where, oh, if you've got $200,000, this isn't for you, which is just, yeah, it's just crazy. Yeah.
Are there any other questions? I think it's near the end of the day, Michael.
Yep. I don't know.
They're exhausted. Well, thank you very much, Michael. And as Michael mentioned, there's the paper to read. So if this has sparked some interest, go ahead and read the paper. I'm sure Mike would be more than happy to answer questions after the conference if you find some after you read the paper. And thank you, Lisa, as well.